From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Donald Trump wrote about the art of the deal, but a new book reveals that some of Trump's best deals were with the politicians he co-opted. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Wayne Barrett about his new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall. Also today, using the guitar like a horn, we talk to free jazz guitarist Sonny Chirac. And commentator Maureen Corrigan wonders why so many Americans are no longer reading books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations sent a written protest to the Iraqi government today after Iraqi soldiers failed to protect a UN inspection team from a hostile crowd in Baghdad. More from Linda Fasulo at the UN.
In a statement released at headquarters, UN officials called the incident a clear breach by Iraq of Security Council resolutions that concern the safety of UN inspection teams. This morning, the UN team, composed of 18 chemical and biological weapons experts, was confronted by about 40 Iraqi demonstrators outside its hotel in Baghdad. Three inspectors were jostled and pinned against the hotel wall. The other team members were trapped inside a bus for nearly half an hour and watched as demonstrators shouted slogans and jumped up and down on UN vehicles. Iraqi police, who were present at the scene, refused to help the inspectors, saying they were not allowed to do so. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
NASA said today that the astronauts aboard the space shuttle Discovery will spend an extra day in space to conduct more experiments. The seven astronauts were supposed to return to Edwards Air Force Base in California on Wednesday. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration said it was able to lengthen the mission because the astronauts used less electricity and water than expected during the first 5 days of flight. The mission is conducting a variety of scientific experiments, ranging from growing crystals in space to experiments with seedlings, insects, and cell samples. As NASA engineers guide the space shuttle through its last couple of days in orbit, their counterparts in Russia have launched a protest for higher wages. The engineers claim rising prices in the Commonwealth of Independent States have reduced their spending power to near poverty levels. As the BBC's Tim Huell reports from Moscow, the highly qualified specialists may take their services elsewhere unless the government acts.
Controllers at the nerve center of the space program hung up placards reading, "Cosmic work, but comic wages." They say that while prices have taken off in the past few weeks, their living standards and morale are sinking lower and lower. Civilian cosmonauts and experts working at the Energia company, which has produced some of the world's largest booster rockets, claim their salary is little more than 600 rubles a month, equivalent to $6. They complain that puts them on a level with building workers and taxi drivers. The staff of Mission Control say they wouldn't take any protest action that would put the lives of space crews in danger. But they admit that many specialists who were once among the most privileged workers in Soviet society are now considering working abroad or with the private companies springing up at home.
The BBC's Tim Huell in Moscow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 8 points to close at 3,240.6. This is NPR News. At least 60 people are reported to have been killed in heavy fighting over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh in the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The latest battle began over the weekend and is apparently still going on. Nagorno-Karabakh is a mountainous region inhabited mostly by Christian Armenians. It lies within the boundaries of the mostly Muslim Republic of Azerbaijan. About 1,000 people are believed to have been killed in the conflict during the past 4 years. A Florida jury has delivered its verdict in the case of what could be America's first female serial killer. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
The jury took little time in finding 35-year-old Eileen Wuornos guilty of first-degree murder and armed robbery. Wuornos was convicted of killing 51-year-old Richard Mallory. Jurors apparently ignored defense contentions that Wuornos killed the Clearwater shop owner in self-defense. Witnesses say Wuornos lashed out at her jury, crying, "I was raped and I hope you get raped." Warnos has a total of 5 murder charges to answer for. She confessed to killing 7 men along Florida roadways. Even if she committed all these killings, experts question whether she's a serial killer or just a multiple killer. In any case, prosecutors say they want the death penalty for the Mallory case. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
The Macy's department store chain filed for bankruptcy protection today. The New York-based retailer has been struggling with a debt of nearly $4 billion. Most of that debt was incurred in a leveraged buyout by the store's senior managers in 1986 and by the 1988 acquisition of the Bullocks and I. Magnin chains. A last-minute rescue plan proposed by CBS Chairman Lawrence Tisch fell through on Friday when a major creditor rejected the terms. On Saturday, Macy failed to make a crucial payment to suppliers. Macy's announced that the bankruptcy protection has allowed it to secure $600 million in new financing from 2 major New York banks. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't too long ago that Donald Trump was offering himself as a model of the successful businessman and sharing his secrets on the art of the deal. Now his empire has collapsed, and he's become more a symbol of greed than success. The new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall, investigates how Trump really made his deals, how he co-opted politicians, used his mob connections, filed misleading financial statements, and relied on the help of his father, Fred Trump, a successful developer. My guest is the author, Wayne Barrett. He's been an investigative reporter for The Village Voice since 1978, which is also when he first started writing about Trump. So, after watching Trump's rise and fall, what's Barrett's angle?
I think one of the real themes of the book is that rather than this Horatio Alger figure that he was made out to be in the 80s, he's really a state capitalist whose wealth was really invented by the politicians that he compromised and that he co-opted over the long stretch of his career, whether it be here in New York or in New Jersey. He insinuated himself in New York development and in the casino industry, industries that were utterly dependent, really, on the decisions of politicians. And he managed, really, in episode after episode in this book, to co-opt political leadership. He learned this, really, at his father's knee. The first political relationships that he manipulated were ones that he inherited from his father, Fred Trump, who was a longtime New York builder. And the then mayor, Abe Beame, and the then governor, Hugh Carey, were longtime associates of his father, and they backed his first project so strongly that he got the largest tax abatement ever granted in the history of the state to build the Grand Hyatt Hotel. It was then valued at $160 million over the course of 42 years. And the story that I detail, for example, and this is just one of many examples of the relationships that he had with politicians, is when he met with the Penn Central executives that owned the land that the Hyatt is now built on. They said he was boasting about his and his father's political connections with Mayor Beame, and they said, well, we want to meet the mayor. And Trump said, well, when? And they said, tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And without calling anyone, he said, my limo will pick you up, and we'll bring you down to City Hall at 2. And sure enough, his limo picked him up, went to City Hall at 2. Abe Beame greeted these Penn Central executives warmly, wrapped his arm around Fred Trump and Donald Trump, and said, anything they want, they get. Well, that's been the history of Trump development projects in New York.
I want to get back in a few minutes to some of the ways that he managed to get his political connections. First, a couple of other things I want to find out. What's left of Trump's fortunes now?
Well, he's basically been reduced to the 3 casinos in Atlantic City, all of which are in various forms of trouble. The West Side Yards project, which is his only real hope for a comeback, where he still hopes to develop that site along the waterfront, still the largest vacant parcel of land in Manhattan, and he hopes to develop it. And he still has Trump Tower and the Plaza Hotel. The Plaza Hotel is just can't meet its debt payments. But Trump Tower is a viable property. It is, of course, a condo building, so almost all the apartments have sold. But he has 17 floors of commercial and office space, which delivers him a rental income. He can sit back in Trump Tower probably for the rest of his life and be a small-time millionaire.
Hmm. Now, Trump's book was called, his first book was called The Art of the Deal. Was he ever really a good deal maker?
He sure was. He sure was. I mean, the initial deals of his life, for example, the Grand Hyatt, obviously I'm talking about in terms of a deal maker, it was political guile more than anything else, but that's certainly an element in his deal making process.
And so it was political, not economic wizardry at work.
Right, but it was the Trump Tower deal, for example, was just, I mean, parts of it, elements of it, were just good deal making. How he assembled the site was an extraordinary, brilliant series of maneuvers. He managed to package an air rights package, a zoning package that was unprecedented in the history of the city, and he got it through the various elements of city review processes, the City Planning Commission, the then Board of Estimate. And again, he plied all those political relationships that he was developing. But nonetheless, it was clearly a brilliant deal.
He got a lot of backing from banks when he needed it. Do you think banks were overeager to finance his deals?
He went before the Casino Control Commission in New Jersey and boasted that the banks were literally dumping money in his lap. They were calling him and asking him to take loans for him. Certainly in the period of the late 80s, Citibank, for example, in a two-year stretch, loaned him $1 billion on four projects. They were all bad loans. All the projects were duds, over-leveraged, overpaid. And they were the Plaza, the Shuttle, which, of course, he had absolutely no airline experience. And they were not only loaning him, making a basic loan to him, they were actually doing second loans in which they gave him the equity that he was supposed to be contributing to the project just on his own personal guarantees. The banks were, the major New York banks, were doing this largely because there was such a demand in the foreign banking markets to get a piece of Donald Trump deals. The Japanese, the Germans, the French, the British, the Canadians all wanted pieces of Donald Trump deals. And for those slices of his deals, they were paying the major New York banks major syndication fees. So that the banks were not applying any of the normal risk-reward ratios to Donald Trump loans because they were essentially farming them out in such finite amounts to so many banks. That's why 75 banks had to be involved, eventually most of them foreign banks, in the restructuring of his loans in 1990.
Why were international banks as well as American banks so anxious to get a piece of Trump's deals?
Well, he was the golden boy. He was the icon of an era. They bought into the whole hype. Everybody, even the bankers, seemed to be getting his credit ratings from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. He could go into a bank boardroom and come out and say to folks it was just like doing the Donahue Show. He just completely wowed them. Obviously, this was in part a result of the success of his early deals. It was also in part a result of Flim Flam. I mean, most of the major New York banks have regulations that forbid them to get involved in any casino financing. All of his casinos were financed through junk bonds. But what happened was they really didn't know anything about casinos. And the only real financial statements that he would give the New York banks were the financial statements from the casinos. And they just showed what seemed to the banks to be an endless supply of cash. So they said to themselves, well, look, Donald is going to be able to cover this. If he gets any problems in the Plaza or the Shuttle, he'll cover it from his casino revenues. Well, what they didn't realize was that there were all kinds of balloon payments due on the casino bonds. And what looked like projects or casinos that could generate cash cows forever, really had very short runs to go before they couldn't meet their own debt payments. So that was part of the flim-flam. I point out specific instances where it was really more than flim-flam. It was bank manipulation. For example, Trump Palace, which is the condo building that he built, went into construction in 1989 on 3rd Avenue in New York when everybody else was bailing out of the market. He started to build. This was supposedly what Donald knew best, New York real estate. He wanted a $220 million mortgage from Citibank, and I have the memos that indicate that he had his own staff do workups on the price list repeatedly because he couldn't get a price list that would demonstrate to a bank that they could ever repay a $220 million mortgage. The first price lists only showed something like $180 million of possible revenue if they sold all the apartments at maximum price. So they kept going back and working over the price lists three times until they came up with a price list that exceeded $220 million. And that was what was used to justify the $220 million mortgage. And those are the kinds of numbers that were floated at the banks in financial statements that were used to deceive the banks. And at that time, they were even considering going public with some of the casinos, and they would have gone public with these hyped financial projections.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Barrett, and he's an investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of a new book called Trump, The Deals and the Downfall. And he's been writing about Trump for many years. As you said before, you think that Trump really built his empire with his political connections. In your book, you investigate his connections to Mario Cuomo. And you say that Trump's penetration of Cuomo's inner circle is a textbook case in seduction. What did Trump do to seduce Cuomo and his organization?
Well, you have to remember that when Mario got elected in 1982, he was the anti-establishment candidate. Trump and all the rest of the major developers and real estate interests were backing Ed Koch, the mayor of New York, in that race. So they had Donald had to do a quick turnabout. And he and many other people were trying to figure out access to the Cuomo administration, the recluse up in Albany. And he tried every conceivable route. He hired the governor's son. He hired retained as an attorney, the person who was the chairperson of the Cuomo Campaign Finance Committee. He hired as a consultant the person that Cuomo installed as the head of the state Democratic Party. He hired the counsel to the state's Urban Development Corporation, which was the economic development agency of the state. He hired the law firm that employed the executive director of Cuomo's Campaign Finance Committee. He even hired the state police driver that had been driving Cuomo around for years and made him his bodyguard. All of these were attempts to ingratiate himself in the inner circle of the Cuomo administration. He also became Cuomo's largest corporate giver in the latter part of the 80s, was appointed to the advisory committee of Cuomo's campaign finance committee. And whenever asked about this constantly reappearing Cuomo presidential candidacy, this registered Republican and otherwise perceived as conservative businessman repeatedly endorsed Cuomo as a presidential prospect as well as a governor. In fact, the Republican Party tried in 1985 to get him to run against Cuomo in 1986. And when he turned it down, he made sure that the Cuomos knew that the head of the Republican Party had come and met with him and tried to get him to run against Cuomo.
What did Trump get out of the connection with Cuomo's inner circle?
Well, there's a series of things detailed in the book. For example, when Andrew Cuomo was retained by Trump, he was retained to draw up the commercial leases for a shopping mall that Trump planned on building in his West Side Yards project. That's where he planned to build the world's tallest building.
Let me interrupt you here. Yes. Andrew Cuomo is Mario Cuomo's son.
Yes, Andrew Cuomo is Mario Cuomo's son. And Andrew Cuomo was retained by Donald to prepare these commercial leases for the shopping mall. Well, the shopping mall was right beside the West Side Highway, and the State Department of Transportation approved the use of public funds to build a ramp directly off the West Side Highway that would lead directly into the shopping mall that Andrew Cuomo was preparing the leases for. Unfortunately, the federal government refused to approve it, really saw it as almost a private use of public funds.
Now, are you saying that the Cuomo administration has been particularly corrupt, or is this business as usual in New York politics?
Well, I wouldn't use the word corrupt. I haven't made any criminal allegation there. What I certainly think that this is unethical conduct. I certainly think that this is the kind of influence peddling. I say in the book that I believe Andrew Cuomo, who is now running a program for the homeless and has left his law firm and is leading a very different kind of life than he did in the mid-80s when these things occurred. But at that time, I think he was clearly involved in influence peddling.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Barrett, investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of the new book, Trump, His Deals and the Downfall. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Wayne Barrett, author of a new investigation into the life and the deals and the influence of Donald Trump. Well, Wayne Barrett, I guess I just wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about Trump's relationship with Marla Maples now.
I do believe, and I think the book makes it quite clear, that his relationship with Marla is, to him, I think, is probably the most serious relationship of his life. I think he is much more involved with her than he ever was with his wife. The people that I interviewed that are very close to Donald told me that he changed when he began seeing her in 1987. That they actually, people who went, these are mostly women who had almost motherly feelings for him, and thought that he was kind of emotionally deprived, believed that he finally found someone that he could, you know, get outside of himself about. He's a very remote, isolated, lonely guy. I mean, for years he and Ivana shared an apartment at Trump Tower but didn't share a bedroom. He would be calling people till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, just sitting there with the channel changer in his hand looking for a show about himself, stuffing a hamburger in his mouth. And that was his lifestyle. Very lonely guy. Marla kind of changed that. Now, they obviously have a tumultuous relationship with all kinds of ups and downs. The ring is back and forth. It's on. It's not on. It's, you know, but there's no question but that Donald finally found some reason to really befriend someone. He doesn't really have any serious male friends either. As hard as I looked, I could not find anyone that people would really describe as a friend, the real intimate of Donald's. He's that closed off a person. He has publicly said that his older brother, Fred Trump Jr., who died at the age of 43 in the early 80s, died because he was too trusting a person. He was an open person and too trusting a person. So he said, "I trust no one."
Americans have really kept themselves entertained on Donald Trump's personal life. I wonder what your attitude toward investigating that part of his life has been.
Well, I tried to keep it to a minimum, but I had to do some of it. It's really a book about him as a businessman, which is most of his life anyway. I mean, there really isn't anything there but babes and business. If he liked to talk much more about the babes than he actually liked to do anything about it, too. I mean, Marla was a very different sort of relationship for him. So there's no question that the fascination with Donald, the reason why he became an icon of an age, much more so than Milken or Boesky or people who had far greater financial influence than him, was because of the way he looked. If he had been a ball developer, he would not have been the icon of the 80s. He was a great visual. He was a great soundbite. Trump Tower, the entrance of Trump Tower, was a great gold-plated visual. It was a combination of all these visuals. It was a man who melded with an age.
You started writing about him a long time ago. What first interested you in Donald Trump, and what was his reputation then?
I did a 3-part series on him that I started in 1978 when he was a rookie and really just into construction with his very first project. He was already a glamorous rookie. Even though he hadn't achieved anything yet, there was a lot of interest in him, a lot of buzz about him. And it was the suggestion of my editor, Jack Newfield, at The Voice, that this guy's going to be big in this town, and Jack has an eye for that. And so I wound up spending 3 or 4 months on an investigative trail, and that trail led to this 3-part series. I spent 15 hours. I did 15 hours of taped interviews with Donald. You know, took rides in the limo, got all kinds of the Trump charm, and it was kind of mixed with. At one point, he offered me an apartment, and the next thing you know, he was telling me about some reporter he had supposedly broken with legal suits, and it was a mixture of the carrot and the stick. And this was young kid Donald. In any event, the piece resulted in the impaneling of the only grand jury to ever investigate Donald. And so not surprisingly, he didn't talk to me again for another 8 years. He did start talking to me again in the late 80s. I thought he was going to talk to me for this book. He indicated he was through an intermediary when I was just beginning on the reporting trail. But then all of his problems hit in 1990, and I just don't think he could answer the tough questions from a reporter who'd been on the trail for months.
There's a growing disparity in Manhattan between the rich and the poor. A lot of the middle class just can't afford to live there anymore. Do you think that Trump's approach to developments helped add to that disparity?
Well, that's the great, you know, the great irony is that really his whole goal in life was to achieve more than the old man. And the old man built 20,000 units of housing for real people that real people still live in. Much of it is still good housing. And Donald has built about 1,000 kasbahs for oil sheiks, you know, offshore investors. You drive by Trump Park, which is right on Central Park, at night, and you don't see a light on in the building. It's black at night because it's all offshore corporations that bought the front apartments. The Japanese bought the most expensive apartments hanging over the park. Somebody might stay there a week or two out of the year. But that's hardly a social contribution. I mean, that's hardly a lasting impression on a town. It's hardly having done something that really has intrinsic merit.
Trump's publicist wanted you to change the title of your book. Your book is Trump, the Deals, and the Downfall. The publicist suggested that you take out the word downfall because Trump is going to make a comeback. Do you think there's any chance of that?
On the eve of publication, Dan Clores, who was then his publicist, he goes through publicists he's no longer the publicist. He goes through publicists very quickly. But Dan Clores called me, and I don't know how they knew that the book was just about to close. I don't know how they knew what the title was. It certainly hadn't been published, but they did know both. And he said, look, Donald asked me to call. This is just a friendly call to tell you that you're going to wind up with egg on your face. You're going to be embarrassed. Your book is going to be obsolete by the time it hits the shelves. He's going to make a comeback. You got to get rid of that word downfall. And I said, tell Donald, as usual, he's been his insightful self. He found the only words in the book that I didn't write, and I will certainly get this message to Harper. The title was not my choice. So in any event, surprise, surprise, a week later, the publicist called back and said, well, did you change the title of the book? I mean, they seriously thought Harper was going to do that. Obviously, Donald is never going to be the Trump that we knew in the 80s. He's not going to have 7 or 8 balls in the air at the same time. He's not going to be doing like he did in 1 month in 1988, both the Taj deal and the shuttle. But he certainly is capable of doing another solid business deal. He may do the West Side Yards. He may do some part of the West Side Yards. He's always going to be a millionaire. His father's 85 or 86 and is worth certainly a few hundred million, so he's going to inherit something. So that we're going to see Donald Trump as a factor in our lives here in New York for a long time, but I don't ever think we're going to see the same kind of person that we saw who melded so well with an age.
Okay, Wayne Barrett, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Wayne Barrett is an investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of the new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall, published by HarperCollins. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sonny Chirac was the first free jazz guitarist, but he thinks of himself as a horn player. His following now extends into the worlds of jazz and heavy metal. Coming up, we talk with Chirac and listen to excerpts of his latest records. And Maureen Carrigan comments on the state of our literary culture. Lots of books, and lots of people who no longer read books. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says that the U.S. has not switched the targeting of its nuclear weapons. His comment came after Russian President Boris Yeltsin said that he wants to stop targeting U.S. cities. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
In an interview with ABC News, President Yeltsin said, quote, "We want to change our military doctrine. Turn our intercontinental missiles away from all cities of the United States." This morning, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater welcomed any measure that reduces the threat and the risk to the United States, but he also said that American targeting remains unchanged for now. "We cannot ignore the fact," Fitzwater said, "that the size of the arsenal in the former Soviet Union has not yet changed substantially, and the targeting of these weapons cannot be independently verified." "We believe him," Fitzwater added later. "We look forward to more details." Asked why Yeltsin had canceled all of his appointments for today and tomorrow, Fitzwater said he had no idea, but that the Russian president is still expected to meet President Bush in New York on Friday and hold talks with him at Camp David on Saturday. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker says that he believes Russia and other former Soviet republics are making sincere efforts to dismantle thousands of battlefield nuclear weapons. Baker, now on a trip to Moscow, also indicated that U.S. officials would soon announce an exchange of experts to speed up destruction of artillery shells, landmines, and other weapons. There has been Western concern that other governments or groups might acquire some of the estimated 17,000 nuclear arms gathered in the former Soviet republics. Mounting debts have forced the Macy's department store chain to seek Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And as it looks for ways to emerge from its financial troubles, the company may have to do business with fewer stores. Daniel Jeffries reports from New York.
A source with Macy's said today reorganization could mean the closure of at least 25 stores out of the 251 in the group, with major job losses. The recession has made it difficult for Macy's to meet interest payments on its $3.6 billion debt, and a poor Christmas left it with an unenviable choice: to pay its bank or its suppliers. The bank has got the cash, forcing Macy's suppliers to withhold new stock. Last week, Macy's hoped it could avoid Chapter 11 when CBS Chairman Lawrence Tisch proposed a $1 billion rescue plan. But this was rejected by one of Macy's major creditors, and when the retailer failed to meet a crucial payment to suppliers on Saturday, it had no choice but to seek protection from bankruptcy this afternoon in the New York courts. The move gives Macy's access to $600 million of fresh credit, which will help put new stock on the shelves. For National Public Radio, this is Daniel Jeffries in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 8 points to close at 3,240.61 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, a UN diplomat has failed to get a key Serbian leader to accept peacekeeping troops in Serbian-held parts of Croatia, in a move that could delay deployment of up to 10,000 UN troops. Earlier today, it had been reported that some progress had been made. UN officials have said that a ceasefire must be firmly in place before sending up to 10,000 troops to help maintain it. Meanwhile, Croatian officials have accused Federal Army troops of truce violations. The Space Shuttle Discovery will spend some extra time in space this week in order to conduct a few more experiments. NASA officials say conditions are right for the shuttle crew to keep the flight going for another day. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA officials say the additional time in orbit will allow astronauts to gather 10 to 15% more data on the growth of protein crystals and information about how the body reacts to weightlessness. The decision to extend the mission was made this morning. The seven-member crew has been conserving power in the hopes of extending the mission. This is in addition to the 48 hours of contingency time that is normally given the shuttle's crew in case they cannot return to Earth due to bad weather. Officials say the crew can now have an extra 24 hours in space. Discovery is now scheduled to land Thursday morning after 8 o'clock Pacific time at Edwards Air Force Base in California. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
According to various UN officials, a weapons team was roughed up by protesters in Baghdad as Iraqi soldiers stood by and watched. A spokesman says three members of the team were pinned against the wall of a hotel lobby until they could get through a crowd by themselves. More than two dozen other team members were trapped inside a bus outside the hotel for nearly half an hour. No one was injured. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During the free jazz movement of the 1960s, saxophonists left behind melody and chord changes for the unstructured abandon of shrieking, squawking solos. My guest, Sonny Chirac, was the first free jazz guitarist, using volume and electronic distortion to get the feeling saxophonists got from overblowing. He was first noticed on the 1967 Pharoah Sanders album, Tahid. He's since recorded with Herbie Mann, Wayne Shorter, Don Cherry, and Miles Davis. But now Chirac is also part of the art rock scene. In the New York Times, he was recently described as the gray eminence of Manhattan's downtown avant-garde. His power playing has won him a new heavy metal following, but his new records, Ask the Ages and High Life, also show his melodic side. Pharoah Sanders is featured on Ask the Ages. From that album, this is a Chirac original called Promises Kept. Described yourself as a guitarist who always thought he was a horn player. Why did you play guitar instead of saxophone?
Oh, I had asthma as a child, and that plus the expense of a saxophone. When I started playing, the guys I wanted to play with, they had a guitar around, so they said, well, play this. And I picked it up and tried to play it.
Now, what did you want the guitar to do that you heard the saxophone do?
Sound like Coltrane. That's what I wanted. That sound that the saxophone players, well, not just saxophone players, like Miles, too, that what used to be called the cry of jazz, that's what I was after, and I'd never heard that done on a guitar, and that's what I wanted to reach.
When you were first starting, what were your early attempts to get that cry?
Oh, boy. When I first started, I was having so much trouble just trying to keep up, trying to, you know, learn changes and scales and keep the time, that I wasn't working on it. It was just in my head. But then after a couple of years, I developed some techniques that I thought would lead me to, you know, reaching that cry. One was a very fast trill, like Albert Eiler did on his saxophone. That's what I tried to do on the guitar, to create a very fast trill. That way I could control the crescendo, decrescendo of the notes, you know, because guitar at that point, back before the electronics had taken such a hold in guitar in 1960, 61, that was the only way to really sustain a note.
By trilling it?
Yes, right.
This is the pre-Jimi Hendrix days.
Yeah, right.
So as you got more advanced, well, let's move up to the present. What do you do now to get the kind of distortion that you sometimes want to have?
I just turn the amp up and play. I don't use any kind of effects anymore. And I just, it's in the hands by now, or else you don't play at all, you know. That's my feeling.
Let me play your solo on Promises Kept. Can you tell us a little bit what you're doing on this?
I don't know, because it was a, it was a one-time thing. I think we recorded it in one take, and which is the way I like to record. So I don't remember at all what I did. I just played what I felt.
So you don't have any gizmos or anything attached to your guitar?
Nothing at all. I do on stage. I use a wireless system because it gives me mobility and I can get around the stage. I like being all over the stage, but that's the only thing I use besides the volume knob. That's
And how do you work the volume?
Well, I use a Marshall amplifier, which is kind of strange for a so-called jazz player, but I turn it up to really usually no more than about 4 out of 10. I turn it up to a 4, and turn the guitar all the way up, the volume knob, and just play. I really believe your sound is in your hands. I've always believed that. Like horn players believe that their sound is in theirs.
Most free bands didn't have guitarists. Was it hard for you to find a place for yourself?
I was lucky because I met Farrell Sanders early on in my time in New York, and I was working with him quite steadily. Now, by that, I mean we were working down at Slugs for $8 a night most of the time, but we were, working and we were playing around. And then I joined Herbie Mann like my second year in New York. So I, went on the road with him for almost 7 years. So I was pretty fortunate in that I, always had a chance to play. A lot of guys didn't. I was just lucky, I guess.
How do you think your playing has changed since then?
I think that I've, as I've grown older, and maybe as you should when you grow older, I've gotten rid of a lot of the things that I didn't need, and I'm down to the essentials now, or very close to it. I'm closer to the melodies that I want to play and much surer of the rhythms that I want to use.
We know, in talking about melody, perhaps the most familiar melody on your recent records is your version of All My Trials. And something I was very surprised to hear.
Everyone's surprised at that.
Yeah. Well, it's an old folk song.
Yeah. That's been a tradition, though, with jazz players, I think. For a very long time to take old melodies and that they may have heard as children or, things from folk music or spirituals, and to play them in a jazz manner.
Let's hear Sonny Chirac's All My Trials from his album High Life. Ever into learning Charlie Christian or Wes Montgomery riffs?
No, and I admire those guys, but I'm just not very fond of the guitar. The standard approach to learning how to play jazz is to listen to your favorite player and copy their licks and then develop your own out of that. And I was starting at 20 years old, and I realized I didn't have time to go through that very long route. I figured that would take 10 years to work yourself out of that, to find yourself. So I just started right out playing what I heard in my head. And at that time, it was very little. But, that's the way I did it. I never played anyone's licks. I think I do know one Coltrane lick that he was very fond of playing on ballads. And sometimes I do that just for fun. But I never played anyone else's riffs, no.
You say you're still not fond of the guitar?
No, I don't like it. It's not as human as the horns.
Because there's no breath in it?
Maybe that's what it is. I guess that's what it is. But it just doesn't have the same. Even piano players get a more human feeling from their instruments. You know, you take someone like a monk who just, you know, that every time you hear, monk could play one note and you would know it was him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they get such a good feeling from the instrument. But guitar, and especially jazz guitar, when I started playing back in the early 60s, it all sounded exactly the same. I, the other night I heard a guitar player, and I realized that when a guitar player plays chords, and you'll see these guys with these magnificent hands, and they play chords that go 10 frets and things, you know, all these crazy things they do, and it all sounds like it could fit on a postage stamp. Guitar is exactly the same from the top of the guitar to the bottom of the guitar, you know, when you do it like that. And that's why I'm not so crazy about it. It just doesn't have the scope of other instruments, you know.
Is this to say that if you could, you would change your instrument tomorrow?
No, I don't have to because I'm already a tenor player. Lots of guys laugh. I know Farrell Sanders always cracks up when I tell him that, but it's true. I never have looked at myself as a guitarist.
But you are, you know.
No, I'm not.
You still have asthma?
Well, when my wife asks me to do certain things, yeah. you know, like, if, you know, women have a thing about painting, you know. They like to paint apartments and things, and I hate that. And whenever she gets into, oh, well, maybe we should paint, the asthma thing will jump up then, you know.
But you could blow if you wanted to now.
No, I don't think I could. I don't think I could. And I'm 51 years old now. It's too late to start that.
Guitarist Sonny Chirac is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist Sonny Chirac is my guest. So tell me what you think some of the advantages and disadvantages have been of, like, bypassing the standard way of learning jazz, you know, learning other people's riffs off of records and, you know, coming up through bands when you're in your teens and things like that, the things that you miss because you started when you were 20.
Yeah, I think the main advantage is that you're already on target when you start. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I knew how I wanted to do it, and I wasn't able to yet, because you still have to develop technique.
How did you deal with the frustration of being 20 and hearing something in your head but not having the technique to get it?
Well, I had no choice. I remember when I was in seventh grade, my teacher said to me, she said, you're a very bright young man, and I don't want to see you end up working in a factory. And she scared me to death with that because I had not a clue as to what I wanted to do at that time. But that's what's always driven me, is that I knew there was something special inside me. Not that I'm so special, but there were some special things inside me. And I wanted to get to those things. And I didn't want to, you know, end up someplace where I couldn't use those things.
Do you think if it hadn't been for music, you would have ended up in a factory?
Oh, I would have been dead by now, I'm absolutely sure.
Of what?
Probably whatever young men die of in the street. I was the typical urban teenager, you know, leader and warlord of the social gents, you know, the whole thing. I did that whole street thing. So I'm sure music saved me. And that when I started playing music, I stopped doing any kind of drugs and I, you know, got very much into the music. I remember once my mother, I was still living at home and working very hard on the music. And I was taking lessons, composition lessons from this guy, and I was at the piano in my room once, and I'd been at it for a few hours, and my mother, I felt someone watching me, my mother standing in the doorway, and she said to me, you know, you need a girlfriend. You know, right then I realized that maybe I was going at it a little too hard.
You are now involved with, you know, people in the art rock scene and the Manhattan's downtown experimentalists. Were there years when it was hard for you to find your place, you know, in the years after the free jazz of the 60s, in the years between then and now?
Someone in Europe called those lost years. I was working around New York at different places, Verna Gillis's Soundscapes and places like that. I was working in Europe at least two or three times a year. I just wasn't recording, so that kind of takes you out of the picture. But I was working, and mainly I was working on the music that I'm playing now. I was writing it and developing the style that I'm playing in, so I was, you know, spending a lot of time on the guitar, just developing my music.
It's hard to make a living when you're staying at home composing, though.
Yes, it is. So you end up doing a lot of things that you don't want to do, like chauffeuring and what else was I doing? I was working in schools with disturbed children and things like that.
Doing music with the children?
Sometimes doing boxing with the children, whatever it took to get, you know, to control them a lot of times. I mean, you know, it was a pretty rough time for me, but everybody has rough times, I think.
What kind of chauffeuring were you doing?
I was driving for this real estate guy, you know, all over the city to different appointments that he had.
Huh. In one of the scenes that you're involved with now, you're kind of a senior member, because, so, you know, a lot of the people are a lot, not that you're particularly old, you're, what, 51 or something?
51, right.
Yeah, but a lot of the other people are more in their 20s or 30s, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make you feel older than you are?
No.
To be the older member?
The guys in my band call themselves Sonny's Kids, you know? But I don't even think about age. I'm just so happy to be playing good that I don't care. It doesn't matter. You know, I've got a long way to go. I've just discovered myself, you know. It's just now starting to happen for me musically. I now am able to play the things that I hear.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you. I want to thank you very much.
Oh, it's been nice talking to you.
Sonny Chirac's new albums are High Life on Enemy Records and Ask the Ages on the Axiom label. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have news today. Terry of Macy's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Also a report by Richard Gonzalez, our White House correspondent, on the promises about the economy that George Bush made when he ran for president 3 years ago and how those promises stack up against his performance since. We'll also be talking with two of the comedians who will be part of the coverage team for Comedy Central, the cable television channel, which, like the other big networks, will be carrying George Bush's State of the Union message, although their coverage is likely to be a little bit different. And as our series on the republics of what used to be the Soviet Union continues, we consider today Armenia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maureen Corrigan says this has been a grim few weeks for book reviewers. Two recent news items have made her think that book reviews and books rank way down there in terms of importance to most Americans.
A couple of weeks ago, most newspapers ran a list of the nominations for the National Book Critics Circle Award for 1991. I can't argue with any of their picks. In fact, I too would have voted for Gish Jen's first novel, Typical American, and Thomas Gagin's Which Side Are You On?, an autobiographical look at the sluggish American labor movement. But I didn't vote for either of these books because I've never been able to find the NBCC, National Book Critics Circle, to become a member. The NBCC is the most important, in fact the only, nationwide organization of book critics. When I first tried to join them a few years ago, I wrote to the address listed in the Encyclopedia of Associations, an exhaustive three-volume tome. 4 months later, the post office returned my letter stamped no such address. I looked up the NBCC again in the 1992 edition of the Encyclopedia. It said, address unknown since 1991 edition, which was the wrong address in the first place. It sure makes you feel special when the preeminent organization in your profession doesn't even have a storefront to operate out of. But it probably doesn't matter what books reviewers endorse, because it seems that lots of people in America aren't reading books anyway. A couple of weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal quoted a new survey of consumer book buying habits that revealed that 60% of American households didn't buy a single book last year. That's hardcovers and paperbacks. Can this be true? Not even a cat book or a cookbook? And of all the mass market paperbacks that were sold, the survey determined that almost half were romance novels. I read about this survey on the same day that I read an amazing passage in Richard Wright's autobiography, Black Boy. When Wright was growing up in the South in the 1920s, he wasn't allowed to use the public libraries, so he got books by pretending he was fetching them for white people. The first book Wright took out was H.L. Mencken's Book of Prefaces. Here's Wright's recollection of that reading. "That night, in my rented room, while letting the hot water run over my can of pork and beans in the sink, I opened a book of prefaces and began to read. I was jarred and shocked by the style. Occasionally, I glanced up to reassure myself that I was alone in the room. Who were these men about whom Mencken was talking so passionately? Who was Anatole France, Joseph Conrad, Sinclair Lewis, Sherwood Anderson, Dostoevsky, George Moore, Gustave Flaubert, Mark Twain, Poe, Thomas Mann, Nietzsche, and scores of others? Were these men real? Did they exist or had they existed? And how did one pronounce their names?" Wright is like an explorer here, discovering the new continent of literature. I don't know what turned someone like Richard Wright into a reader. He had no encouragement from family or teachers. Still, he decided he needed to read as desperately as he needed to eat. But here's something that's an even greater mystery to me. Why is it that these days, when pretty much anybody has the freedom to read any book, why is it that so many people in this country are reading nothing?
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Bob Alls. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two people who are educating others about AIDS. One has taken her crusade into crack houses and on street corners where prostitutes work. The other is working in Hollywood, where actors who are HIV positive are afraid if anyone finds out, they'll never work again. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.